Hi, you're watching DNA Today, a multi-award-winning genetics podcast where we explore everything to do with genetics, from CRISPR to rare diseases to new research. We have won the Science in Medicine Podcast Award for many years now. We have hundreds of episodes, and we really hope you enjoy these conversations where we dive into so many genetic concepts. I'm Kira Dineen, a certified genetic counselor and your host. In this episode, we're learning about OTC deficiency. To do so, we are joined by three experts that I have to say have quite the experience with OTC deficiency that I think is really going to be very beneficial for this conversation. Dr. Amy Dudley is a senior investigator at the Pacific Northwest Research Institute. Her laboratory performs genetic research that is used to aid in variant interpretation, which is something we have talked a lot about on the show, and we will continue to as we learn more in this space. Dr. Andrea Grotman is the principal investigator of the Urea Cycle Rare Disease Consortium and the division chief of neurodevelopmental pediatrics and neurogenetics at Children's National Hospital. To speak about her personal and family experience, Tressa Warner will provide her insight as a mother of a child with OTC deficiency. She also serves as the president of the National Urea Cycle Disorders Foundation. So I wasn't kidding about having experts on the panel. Thank you, all three of you, for coming on and sharing all of your expertise.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So Dr. Grotman, I thought we could start with you of learning a little bit of the background information about urea cycle disorders before we get more particular with OTC deficiency. What do these disorders have in common? What are some of the general symptoms when we think about urea cycle disorders?
Sure. So, you know, as you said, urea cycle, it's a cycle. So there are a number of enzyme deficiencies, six to be exact, and two transporters. And the sole purpose is basically to detoxify the nitrogen from the protein that you take in your food and to make it into a harmless compound called urea, which is easily excreted from the body. And so, you know, each enzyme or transporter has a role in this process. And so having a variant or a mutation, as we used to call it, in one of these enzymes can lead to deficiency. Now, depending on where you are in the cycle, the first four enzyme deficiencies are typically associated with hyperammonemia, which has significant neurologic, or can have significant neurologic impact, but the liver can also be involved. And then one disorder is very different, is arginase deficiency, which presents more with a spastic diplegia.
And with that, you mentioned, you know, that ammonia building up in the body and not being able to break down, you know, like in, I don't have one of these disorders, so like in my body breaks this down and excretes it. So tell us a little bit more about OTC deficiency specifically. So, I mean, first of all, what does it stand for? It's probably a good place to start. And just the biomechanism behind this specific urea cycle disorder.
Sure. So it stands for ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency, which is a mouthful and why we call it OTC. We speak a lot in acronyms, but it's nice to know what it stands for. So this particular enzyme is in the mitochondria. And, you know, it's one of the first few enzymes of the cycle. And so it's really trying to take the bulk of that ammonia and detoxify it. And it's also the most common of the urea cycle disorders, and it's X-linked. So, you know, males who have the OTC gene deficiency develop symptoms. Females are a mosaic because of X inactivation. Some may have features, some may not. Some may have mild features and not recognized as having features. So it's actually a very interesting disorder from that standpoint. But the main and most serious aspect of OTC is the hyperammonemia and its effect it can have predominantly on the brain. So individuals can have behavioral changes, they can have cognitive changes, they can have significant hyperammonemia with coma. They can have seizures. So it's really something that needs to be recognized and treated immediately before things can get worse.
Yeah, certainly, because it's, you know, as the ammonia builds up, that's causing more and more problems. So the prevention seems to be very key for disorders like OTC deficiency. And Teresa, how did you first discover that your child might have OTC deficiency? I mean, tell me a little bit about your discovery of this and just how that was first on your radar.
So my daughter
is late onset OTC. So there's neonatal and there's late onset. So she was late onset. She was developing normally until about 9 months when we started to introduce whole foods. The symptoms were she was lethargic, she had failure to thrive, irritability, an uncontrollable crying, and sleeping for long periods of time. It took us about 5 months to get her diagnosed after going to hospital after hospital specialists. She was misdiagnosed with array of things, autism, acid reflux, colic, and it took a sharp resident that took the time to kind of look at the whole picture. It took us 21 days once we kind of thought we knew what it was. This was 25 years ago. They told us that we knew it was OTC, but we don't have low protein formula and we don't have a way to get the medication. So it was a really scary time 25 years ago. Thankfully, it's not as scary as it used to be. And it is becoming easier to diagnose as long as we have, you know, accessibility to care and awareness.
Yeah, and it certainly it's really good that things are different than it was 25 years ago, as you illustrated. But props to that resident, especially being a resident, to be able to pick up on that. I mean, it's so important that we see this in the rare disease space a lot, where people are misdiagnosed or not diagnosed for a long time. And, you know, and we'll get into kind of, you know, some of the screening and everything. But and I imagine, you know, having a of your daughter having symptoms and just being female, that probably was also, I imagine, part of the misdiagnosis of them not thinking this condition over others.
Yes. And it was, you know, her symptoms, once she would be in the emergency room and on IV, her symptoms would subside because she would become hydrated. And so it was a lot of hit and miss. And you know, her father and I knew that this, every diagnosis, we knew that just wasn't it. Once we got the diagnosis of a urea cycle disorder, we knew that was it. It was checking off all the boxes. All the symptoms made sense to us. And, you know, we never thought that this was food induced. We never thought that that was what was causing the problems. And now, you know, that's one of the things that I think a lot of young moms look at. They look at food and start eliminating. And 25 years ago, that just wasn't something that we considered. And that turned out to be, you know, one of the key factors.
Yeah, it's very different than it was. And I can't imagine how frustrating that was with the misdiagnosis, but also for healthcare providers listening, it is so important to be listening to the patient advocates and the caregivers of that child, because they know them more than we do. And no matter how many hours you might spend with a patient, and usually it's not hours, that you have to listen to the parents, because if it's not sitting right with them and they're like, it seems to be something else, like I think gut feeling is, from what I hear from parents, especially in the rare disease space, that is, it should weigh a lot on, is this diagnosis correct? Does this really fit everything? Because it's hard, I think, for healthcare providers to be looking at it from a 360 view and not just the specialty that they're in and just, you know, how long your diagnostic odyssey was. And for some people, it's much longer, but, you know, it's, I think it's important for healthcare providers to see and listen to patients and truly take in what they're saying, because that is a huge, major factor of being part of that. Now, Dr. Grotman, I mean, we kind of hinted on this a little bit with Tressa sharing with her daughter, but what is the standard answer in terms of, like, how is OTC deficiency treated? And you also mentioned it's very urgent to be treating right away, but can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Sure. I just wanted to go back and say that I think my fellows and anyone who's worked with me knows to take that 5-minute diet history, especially when the symptoms are complex or the patient has neurologic findings, whether it's the central or peripheral nervous system, because we know that also these elimination diets can cause their own problems neurologically with neuropathies and things like that. So for OTC, you know, because food is the problem, the excess protein is the problem. On the one hand, you want to decrease the external protein, so the exogenous protein in the patient's diet, so low protein foods and low protein formulas. However, you want to make sure the individual has enough calories so that they're not becoming catabolic, because that could be a source of endogenous nitrogens or protein breakdown that could also cause the patient's ammonia to rise. So I think a common mistake sometimes is when the patient comes in and is put on an IV fluid for extended periods of time without any protein. And the providers say, well, I don't understand, you know, why the ammonia is still elevated or why it bounced back up after coming down. So I think sufficient non-protein calories plus protein restriction that will vary for each individual. So based on their enzyme deficiency, there'll be a different tolerance for protein. The neonatal onset may have very little protein in their diet that has to be split across meals and snacks, whereas someone who has a later onset, and later onset, so the misnomer for late onset is anything after 6 weeks of age, so could include a 60-year-old, you know, individual, for example. So they may have more tolerance for protein. So it's really geared to the patient. So that's one. The other are medications called scavengers. So these basically suck up the extra nitrogens and complex them to make less toxic compounds that can be excreted in the body. Again, scavenger use varies amongst patients and needs to be titrated to that individual. There's not a one-size-fits-all. So that would be, you know, kind of your baseline treatment. And then this use of scavengers during an acute hyperammonemic episode in addition, and using arginine, for example, 10% arginine IV for patients with OTC who are in crisis with hyperammonemia. For some individuals, liver transplantation may offer, and I think Teresa will talk about that later, whether it's done earlier or later in the course. So you're essentially giving the individual a whole new liver, so they're giving them a whole new urea cycle or enzyme system. And then there are, you know, therapies that are under consideration that have not yet hit the market yet. So, you know, DNA, RNA-based therapies, gene therapies, et cetera.
Yeah, it seems to be a really great time for just seeing how a lot of these treatments, especially for rare diseases, are being developed. And Dr. Dudley, I see a lot of nodding. Anything else that you want to add in there?
Yeah, well, I guess one thing is that, you know, 25 years ago, you know, one real game changer that did not exist was the ability to do rapid and cheap whole genome sequencing. So that's something that, you know, I know is the subject of the podcast. Yeah.
Yeah, and let's get into that, because I think it is very exciting that we now have access to rapid whole, and you said exome, right? Not genome.
Exome,
I mean,
and
it
genome.
Could be both. Yeah. Yeah, I guess both. It depends on the situation. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. That, you know, the more DNA that we're looking at and analyzing, the more we're going to have what's called variants of uncertain significance, where we say, all right, we see a genetic change, but we don't know, does this make the gene not work and we're going to have symptoms from that? Or is it just, you know, the beauty of, as listeners know, I say this phrase a lot, like just human diversity. And it's just like a little bit different. Like everybody on here doesn't have the exact same eye color. One is not better than the other. It's just change, right? So, I mean, how has this worked with, I know, which is really cool. And people are going to say like, this sounds weird, but it's cool. You guys have used yeast to look at some of these variants to figure out, are they benign, like they're fine, they're just, you know, a change, or they're pathogenic and they're actually leading to an issue that would lead to a genetic diagnosis of OTC. So, I mean, first of all, I guess my first question, Dr. Dudley, is why yeast?
Yeah.
Because I don't hear yeast being used a lot.
It's, you know, and for yeast researchers like me, it's always funny to hear people say that. We hear it all the time, because there are thousands of research labs across the country and across the world who are using yeast to address.
I just need to interview more people is what I'm hearing.
Yeah. So first of all, when we say yeast, which yeast are we talking about? Because there are lots of different yeasts. So the yeast that we're talking about is baker's yeast or brewer's yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And most of your listeners are, I'm sure, familiar with it because, you know, everybody was so busy baking during the pandemic. So this is the same baker's yeast that we're talking about. And so one of the reason why researchers like me, geneticists and technologists like me and my group, use yeast so frequently is because it's a simple model system. So it's a single-celled organism. But importantly, like many of the biological processes that happen in our human cells also happen in yeast cells. And in fact, so things like metabolism are so similar, are often so similar between yeast cells and human cells that you can, in fact, remove the yeast gene. So, for example, the gene encoding OTC in a yeast cell, we can chop it out of the genome so that there's no source of that enzyme present in a yeast cell, and we can actually put back into the yeast. We can replace it with the human protein coding sequence. And in cases where the enzyme function, the enzymes and their functions are so similar to each other, that human protein coding sequence will be able to functionally replace the loss of its yeast ortholog. We call it an ortholog, so the corresponding yeast gene. And when that's the case, what that allows us to do is to use what we call the awesome power of yeast genetics, and that's actually a real term.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
So one of the things about the awesome power of yeast genetics is that we can rapidly, quickly, and cheaply manipulate yeast at will, basically. So, for example, we can take these, not only the human protein coding sequence for what we call the wild type, right, the version that most of us have, but we can actually put in thousands and thousands of different variants into yeast cells, and then we can test how well they function, and we can do that quantitatively. So for example, the work that we've done in collaboration with Andrea and some of our other collaborators at Children's National Hospital has measured thousands or 1,500 OTC variants that are amino acid substitution variants. So these are the ones that are really difficult to predict what they're going to do using, for example, computational methods. And so we take 1,500 of our really difficult cases, and we put them into yeast, and we test how well they function on a really intuitive scale from 0 to 100%, where 0 is complete loss of the enzyme or its function, and 100% is how well the wild type human protein functions. So we've been able to do this, and of course, a really important aspect of this, and it's something that we don't, as model organism researchers, yeast as a model organism, have the opportunity to do very often. The really crucial part of these assays, right? We have the technology, we have the awesome power of yeast genetics, we have the ability to sequence, verify all of these yeast constructs, to use robotics to, do this stuff in really large scale, high throughput. But what we rarely have the opportunity to do is to work so closely with clinicians and disease experts to be able to see how well our functional assays are relating to what's seen in human patients. And that's where this collaboration has been so spectacular.
Wow. And I mean, you said you've tested this for 1,500 different variants. That's a lot. I don't remember how big this gene is, but I can imagine that you've been able to classify a good chunk of these variants that we're not sure about based on this study. Am I getting that right, or am I jumping ahead?
No, absolutely, absolutely. So we measured over 80% of all possible amino acid substitution mutations that are accessible via a single nucleotide variant.
80%. That's astounding. I did not think it was going to be that high. This is wow. So, okay, side note, why are we not doing this for a bunch of different other disorders? Or is that it's happening and I'm just not aware of it?
So that's a great question. So these types of assays are spectacular ways to really be able to quantify and provide functional information, which is really important for variant interpretation, for a large number of genes. So good question is, well, Amy, how often can we how often can we do this for a given gene, right? A given human gene. And so, you know, the human genome has about 20,000 genes in it. And for over 4,000 of them, there are really good yeast orthologs, right? So there's a corresponding yeast and human gene pair that we can identify. So that's interesting. So could you do this type of functional assay for every single one of them? And probably not every single one of them. In fact, definitely not every single one of them. For genes that encode highly conserved metabolic enzymes, probably about 80 to 90% of those genes that encode metabolic enzymes are genes that you will be able to develop these types of functional assays for in yeast.
No, that I didn't realize just how powerful that is, and that it's pretty easy to manipulate too. I guess my last question on that note is, are you using CRISPR to then take that working gene out and then replace it with the one with the variant of interest?
So we can use CRISPR in yeast, but one of the things about the awesome power of yeast genetics, which is why one of the reasons why yeast has historically been used for genome engineering, is that even without CRISPR, yeast is really easy. It's really easy to manipulate its genome. So for people who really want to geek out on this, homologous recombination, so the ability to swap in and out genes and do genome engineering, the native yeast machinery actually works really efficiently. And so we're actually even able to do this without CRISPR.
Wow. I am so fascinated by this. This is incredible that you're able to do all this, and just how many variants you've been able to classify with this, because the variants of uncertain significance, VUSs, are really challenging, because doing genetic testing, especially years ago, but even still today, I imagine it's tough when you have that, because you're like, is this really a genetic diagnosis? Like, you know, it's a big question mark there. And, you know, Teresa, I know we alluded to some of the treatment that your daughter has had, you know, and I think including a liver transplant. So this is information that is crucial to know in order to treat, as Dr. Grotman was also talking about, you know, the different treatments. But I mean, you know, as a parent of someone that has gone through a liver transplant, I mean, can you tell us a little bit about that experience? And just, that must have been very difficult for your family to go through. And that's not an easy procedure.
No. So my daughter went through high school and was beginning to go to college and wanted to live an independent life. And her mutation was on the severe side. And so being independent was just not going to be an option for her. And so when she became 18 years old, it was a decision that she and her medical team, and it was over years of discussing it. She was waiting for gene therapy. She was waiting for the miracle. And, you know, the years just kept going by, and she knew that for her, that transplant was the right decision. So in 2019, she was transplanted, and she just graduated from college. And so it worked out for us. It's not for every family. Every family has to, you know, consider what's best for them. We did medical management for 19 years, and there was, you know, some struggles with that. Our treatment options are improving. And, you know, each family, each mutation, you know, male or female, age of diagnosis, those are all things that each family has to consider. But, you know, right now we have three. We have medical management, liver transplant, and then, you know, coming soon will be, you know, the DNA option.
Yeah, to change someone's genetics, basically, so that they have this wild type that we're referring to, that, you know, that doesn't have the pathogenic variant that leads to symptoms there. That is, you know, the very exciting forefront.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell me a little more about how it was before the transplant. What was, like, you know, the just daily living, and how was it managed at that time before, you know, she was going off to college, and, you know, of doing the transplant in 2019?
Living with the urea cycle disorder is kind of a moving target. There's so many stressors and factors that play into staying healthy. Managing diet for young adolescents and teenagers is difficult. You know, adherence with medication, and medication has its own side effects that you have to consider. The social issues, the wanting to, you know, do everything that everyone else their age is doing, playing a sport. Our daughter played a sport under the, you know, really strict, eye of her genetic team to make sure that she stayed hydrated and didn't, you know, decompensate. There were lots of hospital visits, and it really took a toll on her. And when it comes to the family, this is not a condition that affects the child. It affects the family and the extended family. It really takes a village to take care of a patient with the urea cycle disorders. With that, there are lots of degrees. We have a lot of adults that are functioning very well in society and are able to live with OTC and, you know, have a job and have children. They have a much milder mutation. And then we have those that have a much more severe mutation. So it is not one size fits all. At NUCDF, you know, our main focus is helping families navigate their version and helping them personalize their health care to their, you know, to their family's needs. But it was a real struggle. It really was. And, you know, one of the things over the past 25 years is we have helped bring new treatment options to the forefront. But with those, with the medical management, new medication, you know, comes with its own challenges. So you always have to consider that. But hospital stays, ICU visits, those are all just part of life.
That it's just really going to happen if someone has a severe enough case that you're going to ebb and flow in life and yes. Have certain times where it's more, I don't know if you use the word crisis, but something up along those lines.
Yes. Yeah. There were many crises. There were times when we were very scared. And then there were times when she was so healthy that we, you know, tended to let our guard down, which you should never do, because the minute you do, it will come back and remind you that you have to stay diligent.
Yeah. And it sounds like based on the different type of variant or mutation that can influence what the treatment is. So the genetics itself can also predict the severity. So Dr. Grobman, I don't know if you wanted to comment on this of how the genetic diagnosis influences like the type of treatment that, you know, doctors prescribe or keeping up with things, or even if once it's diagnosed of sitting down with those parents and caregivers and saying, okay, this is kind of like the case that we're looking at. Am I in the right realm there?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the past when we didn't have much to offer, it was the more of the one size fits all, but there wasn't much to give. You know, now that we know more about these patients and we've studied them, our work through the UCDC and also the work that we've been doing with Amy, you know, to really understand how a particular variant influences the enzyme capabilities and potentially the prognosis, right? So that's the important thing is being able to give an appropriate prognosis. And we really didn't have that. But now we're recognizing that each patient is an individual and that the diagnosis will confer some individual differences in the therapeutic pathway.
Yeah, I think that's good, even especially for students listening, just, you know, as they're studying for boards. Like I remember studying this condition and just looking at it of being like so many different genetic disorders, kind of being a spectrum where some people are going to be more severe than others. And, you know, keeping in mind that people can with many conditions, but especially ones that are metabolic in nature, can go through periods of time that are relatively healthy, like you're saying about your daughter, but also times that are, you know, not as healthy and really going through crises and staying in the hospital and really that shift. And I think another thing that we said at the top of the show was that this is an X-linked disorder. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important for students as you're memorizing for boards and, you know, going into clinic, like this is one that, you know, is a little bit different in that sense. compared to other similar disorders there. But thank you, all three of you, for coming on. I've learned so much about OTC deficiency. And, you know, the yeast stuff is blowing my mind, I have to say. Now I'm going to go into a wormhole after this of just going into all the information and what we have out there. But thank you, all three of you, for just coming on and sharing all of your expertise and educating the audience. I really appreciate it. And just, you know, selfishly, I've learned so much. So thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for watching DNA Today. To access all of our episodes, head over to dnatoday.com. We also have a lot of bonus content on there that you can enjoy. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, guest pitches, you name it, send them in to info@dnatoday.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could take a moment to rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to the show. It really helps more nerds like yourself find the show. Also, if you like giveaways and other ways to connect with us, I recommend following us on social. We're at DNA Today Podcast. We also have a Patreon if you want to be the most level involved in the show. That's also at DNA Today Podcast. Thank you so much for listening and watching. Join us next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.